You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of December 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme...
Jerusalem is Israel's capital. No one can deny it. It doesn't obviate peace. It makes peace possible because recognizing reality is the substance of peace.
Will the European Union follow the United States' lead on recognizing Jerusalem? My guests, Ed Stocker and Marie Billon, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including... Who is the new leader of the Republicans in France, and can he unite the party? Why, almost 1 year on, are there still 20 US ambassadorial positions to fill? And we discuss Saudi Arabia's decision to bring back cinemas more than 3 decades after the last picture was viewed in the kingdom. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Yes, a warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are indeed Marie Billon, a UK correspondent for French media, and Ed Stocker, Monocle's New York bureau chief here in London. Welcome both to Midori House. Let's start today's programme in Brussels, where Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has arrived for talks, becoming the first Israeli PM to visit the city in more than 20 years. And Marie, I'll come to you first of all. Clearly, the issue at the top of the agenda today was Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. And it's quite interesting. Netanyahu said he expected European countries to follow suit. I was going to ask you how likely is that to happen. But to turn it around somewhat, has the era where countries did follow suit to what the US did on the foreign policy stage come to a decisive end?
Well, I guess with Trump, yes, it has to come to a decisive end. And on this issue in particular, it's just so sensitive that whatever the US says, you always got to do its way and stick to the international consensus, which is Jerusalem should be the capital of both states on the line of 67. And that's what the foreign policy chief reminded yesterday. Basically, it's like, you know, Netanyahu arrived in Brussels like a bull in a china shop, in a way. He arrived with his conviction that Trump has put the truth out and acknowledged the truth, as he puts it, and that Brussels now has only to follow suit, whereas it's so complicated, this issue, and he ignores the complexity of it because it suits him, basically, whereas Brussels is known to be very boring because very much on the complexity. So it's down to clash, but at the same time, of course, it's important that it doesn't really clash, that it's still very amicable and all that. And of course, yesterday Netanyahu was in Paris. He met Emmanuel Macron, who's very much on the line of Brussels, saying that on this, you know, international consensus. So he arrives like a bull in a china shop, although yesterday he was warned what Brussels is going to say.
We'll come to that meeting with Macron in a moment. But Ed, it struck me as interesting hearing that quote from Netanyahu at the top, where clearly the path to peace is to agree with Netanyahu, which is an interesting sort of anti-logic as it comes to political disagreements that I'm sure he must share with Donald Trump, who presumably also subscribes to the idea that the way you resolve a argument is to talk about it and decide he's right.
It's just to knuckle down. Yeah, I mean, maybe. I mean, we know that he's pretty hard-headed, and we've seen in the past that Netanyahu has been, for example, that infamous time at the UN General Assembly when he got out that sort of cartoon-esque picture of the bomb, which literally looked like it had its kind of lit fuse and it was a round thing which didn't have any bearing on reality. So we know that, you know, Netanyahu's playing to, you know, his base, one can say, the Israeli base that supports this line. But despite his bravado and his sort of declaration that this is simply Trump speaking the truth and it's something that should be said, there doesn't seem to be any suggestion from any EU members, and to be honest, the wider international community, that they're prepared to take this line. As Marie was saying, it is so nuanced and complicated. We've seen, you know, that there have been protests now in their fifth day in everywhere from France to Lebanon, and you know, one gets the sense that taking such a sort of almost unilateral stance only pours petrol on the flames. And most countries don't want to do that, except it seems Donald Trump's America.
Well, to that point, we spoke earlier about the fact that Trump is talking to his base. And this is oft quoted. This is the president that simply isn't interested in the foreign policy agenda because it doesn't affect his numbers. Now, we know, of course, there's the powerful pro-Israel lobby, and there is a demographic within the United States who care profoundly about whether or not the US embassy is in Jerusalem and if Jerusalem's capital of Israel. But even surely for many of Trump's core supporters at home, one imagines this is not an issue which is of particular significance. So do you still think that his calculation would be that it's worth the punt?
Well, I think, I mean, you can argue that he doesn't get that involved in the nitty-gritty detail of foreign policy. But we also know that Donald Trump has an ego. We also know that Donald Trump sees himself as the ultimate deal-maker.
Mm. Is this why he maintains that a Middle East peace process is not only not dead in the water, but he can sort of reboot it, even despite these moves?
I mean, one could argue he might have an inflated sense of self. And I think he feels that if he could pull off both moving the American embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, declaring Jerusalem the capital of Israel, and achieving Middle Eastern peace, he would just be on a whole new level of dealmanship. But back in the real world, I think that's pretty impossible to achieve.
Indeed. And Netanyahu, Murray, was very much in the real world. You mentioned he met Macron. And then, of course, you already cited the words of Federica Mogherini earlier as well. What do we know about that encounter with Macron? It doesn't seem to have dampened Netanyahu's enthusiasm to continue with his same rhetoric. But Macron presumably will have done a decent job. What's the French press been saying about the meeting?
Well, he's a bit untested in international issues. Of course, he's untested everywhere. So in international issues in particular. And this one is very, very complicated. But what you have to remember is that first, historically, France is being seen as being more pro-Palestinian than pro-Israel. And we have no reason to think that Macron is going to change its stance, although it's not widely pro-Palestinian. It's more balanced, but somehow seen as being pro-Palestinian. So, of course, Netanyahu arriving to a country that's known to be pro-Palestinian, that's the first thing. Second thing is that in France, when things are not going well at home, and one can argue that things are not going very well at home for Emmanuel Macron, the president had always the possibility to shine his armour, going on the international stage and being...
playing the statesman very much.
That's it, very much so. And this, I mean, one could argue this issue would be the issue to get involved in if you want to make a difference. And some would say, well, it's so complicated, perhaps you should not want to burn your very untrained wings on this issue in particular. So I guess what we know from what happened yesterday is that Emmanuel Macron very much is pro-European and wants to stay on the line of Europe. He sees that very, very important that Europe and countries from the EU stay on the same line as on international major issues. And I'm sure he didn't depart on this in particular when he met Netanyahu. He certainly didn't do the job of the EU, pushing the issue very, very, very far. But he certainly just opened the way for Netanyahu to go to Brussels, letting him know, that's what we think. I'm telling you this now, but tomorrow the EU as a whole is going to tell you the same thing. Just think about it before going there. Mm. Although I know you're not going to change your mind.
No, sadly not. It fell on deaf ears. And just briefly on that point about the peace process, Ed was talking about a kind of acceptance that it's, well, at best floundering and at worst completely dead in the water. That's a view presumably shared in Paris, across the pond, across the La Manche, I should say. There's no... Is there even hope anymore in France? Or are they rather like us here in Britain, cynically saying, look, there is no process?
That's the thing. I think that's exactly the view. There's no process. And I wanted to jump to what's the end of the process, because the issue of Jerusalem is supposed to be discussed at the very end of the peace process. And jumping the queue completely is certainly no way to revive the peace talks. That's that's the general idea, I think, in France.
Well, we're talking about Netanyahu wanting Europe to follow the American lead, but it seems, at least in one regard, that's not possible, as there's, well, really no one to follow. There are 20 US ambassadorship postings in Europe still without anyone appointed, including the post, irony, of US ambassador to the European Union, an organisation we know. Ed, I think it's safe to say Donald Trump is dubious about. This is not a normal scenario, is it? We go back through the recent or even fairly distant past. Normally, the US rather enjoys flexing its diplomatic muscles, and we always await their appointments with interest. Why the stasis, I guess we can call it?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, these figures are from August, and so it, you know, will have changed slightly since then. But Obama had nominated 72% of his positions across government by that stage, and Trump was just on 45% in August. I mean, there's lots of different reasons for this, and it's quite complicated. I mean, part of the reason is that, you know, Donald Trump made the statement at his inauguration that, you know, he was going to rid all politically motivated nominations. And so he kind of purged government, and they all had to leave by January the 20th. So he basically was in a position where he'd got rid of these people and hadn't had replacements. So made life quite difficult for himself. I think there's so many different reasons for this as well. One could argue that the Trump presidency has kind of been against bloating the government with too many different staff members and positions. We've also got the fact that, you know, it is a lengthy process. And if you suddenly kind of sweep across a large chunk of those positions, you have to go, the White House has to select candidates, and it has to go to the State Department. Then the Senate has to approve it. So that's not something that can happen overnight. Mm. So one has to take that into an account if you suddenly decide that all these politically motivated positions have to sort of withdraw, as it were. Add to that whole bubbling mix, if you like, other factors, like the fact that Rex Tillerson, if you believe a lot of what the US media is saying at the moment, isn't exactly the flavour of the month or the week or the day, whatever you want to call it, with Donald Trump. We've seen the fact that, you know, the White House and Sarah Huckabee Sanders hasn't exactly denied the fact that he's not exactly popular with Donald Trump at the moment. Mm. Trump himself answering if he was, you know, leaving. I think he just said he's here, which isn't exactly
a ringing endorsement.
And there's a suggestion that Tillerson has been sort of reluctant regarding some of those nominations that he's felt have been a bit too closely aligned with sort of Donald Trump's new breed of sort of populist republicanism. But at the same time, you have to say that it may also, to a certain extent, reflect the changing pole of influence or interest for the US as well. You know, we talked about the US being less important in the world, but also there's a suggestion that Donald Trump doesn't care about the European Union as much, or Europe. We've seen what he said about NATO, for example, as well. It seems, you know, that he doesn't attach as much importance to forming alliances with Europe, which is why, you know, these ambassadorial openings are largely in Europe. If you look at key positions like Israel and China, whatever he said about China, he still sees it as important. He was very quick to nominate those two places. So I think it's a combination, to give you an extremely long answer, of all those factors.
Very detailed, Ed. Marie, it's interesting what Ed says there. Oh, there's a perception, it's possibly correct, that Trump certainly, and the US broadly, maybe doesn't care about these appointments. But isn't the whole point about international diplomacy is that there are a lot of other stakeholders in that process that do care, and they care profoundly. The EU as a bloc cares, the individual member states care. How would you gauge, and again, I wonder what the view in France is, of the potential long-term damage that this kind of attitude has? Now, whether it is Tillerson saying, oh, well, I'm running the State Department like a corporate body or whatever, this is doing, what, potentially irreparable damage, maybe, to the US as an international player on the diplomatic stage?
Well, it depends. It depends who is in the end nominated, I guess, as an ambassador. If it's a very strong Trump supporter who will never get on with the government of the said country, I mean, it's better perhaps to have just, you know, technicians on the ground because they just do the day-to-day things. I think but it's still very important to have, you know, the ambassador is very much your man on the ground. He's there basically to have lunch with people of importance. That's something that technicians can't do. And that's immensely important, this personal relationship that an ambassador can have. And I think the example, I mean, France has now her ambassador since this summer, and the UK as well has the ambassador. And I think it's very, very, a very nice example. The UK ambassador, the US ambassador to the UK, of course, is Woody Johnson. He's 70. He's a very close friend to Donald Trump. He has a son who's the same age as Barron, so he's a teenager. So 70-year-old, a teenager son, he must have had a younger wife. So you think that somehow they're, you know, kind of the same men somehow on some level. I mean, I might be jumping the train here, but you know what I mean. He's a billionaire, and he said in his first speech in London, he said, "If you knew Trump, you'd like him." So to answer your question, if we knew Trump, would we like him? Perhaps sometimes it's better not to know him too much, so because we can you know, keep things amicable. As long as we are not too close.
Very, very diplomatically put, Marie. I feel like I do know Donald Trump, and I don't like the sound of him that much at all, but that's for another day. Let's take a short break now. After this, we'll talk more about politics from France, and the big screen returns to Saudi Arabia after a 35-year-long ban. Stay with us.
Who's up, who's down, and who's out? As the world begins to hunker down for the holidays, we unwrap our annual soft power survey and much more in Monocle's bumper December-January double edition. In a tumultuous year for global politics, we play snakes and ladders with the world's soft power rankings, revealing whose worsening image abroad has seen them take a downward slide and which nations on the charm offensive are climbing to success. We also visit a tiny country with a rich history, San Marino, the world's oldest republic and a nation proud to defend its traditions, crossbow in hand. Next, we grab our first-class tickets, head to our favourite airline lounge and jet into Monocle's annual Travel Top 50. From revamped modernist hotels to the best new high-speed trains, we pack a year's worth of travel highlights into this comprehensive survey. Our voyage continues into the inner workings of National Geographic in our culture pages as we take a peek behind that famous yellow border to see how one of the world's most coveted print titles remain relevant in an ever-changing world. The best is saved until last for you this festive season as our inventory pages unveil Monocle's Christmas gift guide featuring 200-plus present suggestions. From wine and cheese to technology and tools, there's something in here for even the finickiest of friends and family. Monocle's December-January issue is out now. Get your copy today or subscribe at monocle.com.
Welcome back to the programme. You're listening to Midori House. I'm Tom Edwards. Alongside me, Ed Stocker and Marie Billon. Let's continue in France, where yesterday over 230,000 members of Les Républicains Party voted in their new leader, who's taking over, of course, from France's former president, Nicolas Sarkozy. The decision, well, it was former EU Affairs Minister Laurent Wauquiez. Marie Billon, at the start of the year, Les Républicains, presidential hopefuls, you know, we had these expectations, they would duke it out as they always seem to. The rest, though, is history, of course. Macron came from nowhere. And there's rather a sense that it's been downhill and carried on downhill since.
Yes, well, they still have, I mean, they are the main opposition party in the parliament, so it's not, you know, all doom and gloom, but it's true that they used to be the main party in France in general, and they are not anymore, although they are the second biggest party. And you can argue that En Marche is not exactly a party, so whatever you put it, it's not going well for them, but it's not that bad. It's not as bad as the Socialist Party. And you have to remember that, of course, the previous president was a socialist. So yesterday they decided to reinvent themselves somehow with a new president who's never been Secretary of State. He's always been a minister. And he's quite young. He's 42. And there's something that perhaps they want to stick to Emmanuel Macron somehow. We can be young as well. You said there were more than 200,000 people that can vote in this election. They can, but only half of that, decided to vote.
Well, I wanted to ask you about this because there's an interesting narrative saying, you know, this is a decisive vote. And of course, he has secured a sufficiently large proportion of that first round of voting that they didn't need a second round. So outwardly, you'd look at that and say, wow, this guy's a unity candidate. But like you said, 6 out of 10 members didn't even bother. Yeah. So is this appointment, is he a unity candidate, or is there some papering over the cracks, do you think, here?
He's absolutely not a unity candidate. At the moment, Les Républicains is very much divided into the hard right, which is represented by Laurent Wauquiez, and the other one, which is closer to Emmanuel Macron, which is even willing to work with Emmanuel Macron without crossing the Rubicon and going into his own party. Mm. So he's now at the head of a party which is very divided, and some say if you stay as hard as you are on social issues, on identity issues, on immigration, on crime and all that, we might just, you know, walk out and leave your party altogether. Big Beast could do that. So he's certainly not the unity candidate. But it is true that at the moment we have an En Marche party, the presidential party, that is very strong, although, of course, he's having some problem, the president at the moment, but still it's very strong. So he has to reinvent the party to be a credible opposition party. And the only way to be an opposition party when you are from the right wing and when you have a centre president is to be a bit more to the right. And Laurent Wauquiez is very much to the right. He started as a centre-right activist and politicians, but he gradually went to the harder right. He's against the gay marriage. He says that Emmanuel Macron is not tough enough on Islamic states and terrorism and this kind of things. And he's been courted by Marine Le Pen. He always said, I don't want to make any alliance with the Front National, the extreme right. But still, the extreme right, for political reason, of course, but there's something to it. Say, we could work together. That does mean something. And the right in France is very much, doesn't want to be seen as too much in the centre, so too much like Emmanuel Macron, but they certainly don't want to be seen as too much like the far right and Marine Le Pen.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Wherever you look in the world, you get these problems, particularly when you have a president who either swept to power in a rather surprising way like Macron, or in a surprising way like Trump. And one of the key problems is to the political opposition. And in the US, they're wrestling with this, aren't they? If we look to the Democrat movements, you have a party that doesn't quite know, you know, where do we head? Do we head closer to the centre and try and win back support that maybe went to someone like Trump? Do you go back to, you know, if he's representing the right, do you go further to the left? And it's very difficult on the back of a big election defeat to make the right strategic decision wherever you look.
Definitely. And if you talk about that sort of the US scenario, I'd agree with you completely. The Democrats, arguably not in a bad position, with still quite a long way to go ahead of midterms, but the special elections we've seen, the elections we've seen in Virginia, for example, point to perhaps a resurgence of sorts for the Democrats. But obviously, a lot can change ahead of the midterms. What the Democrats have been facing is, like you say, that sort of idea of how to position themselves. Mm. You know, being a moderate party under Hillary Clinton didn't work for them. Now, that probably isn't all to do with the fact that they took that moderate line. It has to do with a lot of factors, including emails and maybe America not being able to deal with the possibility of having its first female president. And we could go on and on. But there's been that question of whether they need to, you know, move to the left to match, you know, Trump's populism on the right with their own sort of brand of leftist populism, which would be, I guess, fall under the mantle of, say, the Bernie Sanders of this world, or even Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. It adds to the mix, though, not just that, the fact that there's also a generational issue inside the Democrats, the fact that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are in their 60s and 70s, and it's not just them. I mean, there's a whole host of aging Democrats who occupy sort of the top kind of part of that organization, of the Democratic Party. So on top of, you know, not knowing where to sort of position themselves, their situation may not be unique, but is different, I think, to perhaps the French example, in the sense that they badly also need young blood, which France has. You know, they badly need some young democratic leaders to come to the fore. And, you know, there have been criticisms of the likes of Nancy Pelosi, who's been around for a long time. I cannot remember exactly off the top of my head. But she's, you know, occupied that position for such a long time. And perhaps for the Democrats to sort of wrest back some of that power, they might need an injection of inspiring candidates going into 2018.
Well, Marie, I was going to ask you about what the socialists need in France, but I don't think we've got enough time.
Yeah, no, we definitely don't have enough time for that.
Let me just ask you about Emmanuel Macron, though. Another challenge for him, a nationalist alliance winning a majority in regional elections in Corsica, which is very interesting. And I wonder, particularly with your from your sort of Monégasque perspective, what does this mean? Is that a tricky challenge for Macron, or does it not really change substantively what he's encountering there?
Well, Macron had to invent an opinion on many things when he ran for the presidency. But one thing he wasn't strong about is Corsica. We don't really know what his position is on Corsica. So it's an open book, basically. But what you have to remember is that, yes, it's a big win for the nationalists. The nationalists won are a merge of the autonomist and the independentist. But they are more autonomist than independentist at the moment. And the autonomists have been winning the local elections for the last 2 years. So it's not exactly brand new in Corsica. We knew that nationalists were on the rise. So Emmanuel Macron will have to deal with that, that's for sure. But negotiation is going to be very important. And the way he conducts a negotiation is very important, because we're arriving to a very sensitive time in Corsica. In February, it's going to be the 20 years of the assassination of a very famous prefect by the independentists in Corsica. And that might, you know, there might be commemoration somehow. Blood can fuse again somehow in people. They just in terms of opinion. I'm not saying there's going to be any more bombing or anything. Just people are going to be more on edge somehow. So he'll have to give in somehow, somewhere. And he might well look to how the UK is working as in terms of devolution. Corsica is quite devolved compared to other regions in France. It's an island, so it's easier, basically. They have an assembly, but they want more. They want more devolved power. And there are a few things that perhaps Emmanuel Macron could give in on without being seen as, you know, just crumbling in front of nationalists, just because it's being recognised at the moment. Corsica has a very different identity, and why not? It's been seen in other countries, like in the UK. Recognising the different identity of a place doesn't mean that they will want to break away. Of course, Scotland is not exactly a good example, but you know what I mean. In the UK, we have four different regions, and only Scotland wants to really break away. So France can just have a very, you know, macho conversation with the nationalists, who seem to be quite mature as well, not a lot want to go back to violence or pushing things very hard. So it can be very, very interesting, I think.
I think it will be. His in-tray is very full, isn't it, Macron? Though I wouldn't recommend anyone look for any kind of ideas to British politics at the moment, but that's definitely another story.
That's arguable, yes.
Just finally on today's programme, to the world of cinema. Not somewhere we alight very often on Midori House, but Saudi Arabia has just announced that after a 35-year-long ban, it's allowing cinemas to reopen in the kingdom. Ed, I mean, we have Crown Prince talking about meaningful social reform, and I guess it's easy to come out with that kind of rhetoric, tougher to actually do things that the citizenry can see. This is a step, or is it an empty gesture in your view?
No, not at all. I mean, I think it's great for the kingdom. It's all part of this Vision 2030. And we've already seen in September, I believe, the announcement that women would be allowed to drive, which comes into force next year. This is just another part of his plan to sort of open up the kingdom of sorts. I think also, I mean, all these social changes, one might argue, are much needed and are great for Saudi Arabia and its citizens. But we also need to, I think, state This doesn't mean that, you know, Saudi Arabia is going to become democratic, or there's going to be freedom of press, or other changes are about to happen. You know, we had a sort of long knives of sort, a night of long knives of sorts in November, when there was a sort of whole anti-corruption campaign and several members of the royal family were arrested. The head of the National Guard was included in that sort of roundup. And what that has done is also give more power to the Crown Prince. So although he's making these changes, he's also positioning himself and giving himself more power.
So this is the progressive agenda, but it all depends what, but it's also, what I think about it. Marie Bion, time is short, but I did want to ask you one question, which is that it's all well and good, I think, opening up the cinemas, but it rather depends what you allow them to screen, right?
Exactly.
This is the question.
Exactly. What you allow them to screen and how people in the cinema can sit. That's very important as well, because at the moment, there's supposed to be perhaps some kind of separation, men on one side, women on the other side. So that would be, I mean, that would be nice to have cinemas, but if they are still complemented, that's not exactly great advance. And there's a lot of, I mean, ban on seeing intimate scenes. What's going to happen? What kind of film can be shown? That's it's a very big interrogation point. What's going to happen?
I think so. The censors office, that's a tough job as well if you're in Riyadh, a job perhaps no one wants. Marie Bion, Ed Stocker, thank you both for joining us here on Midori House. The programme was produced by Carlotta Ribello, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alessio Del Anna, and our studio manager was David Stevens. My thanks to all of them. We'll have more on the big stories of the day on the Monocle Daily at 2200. But from me, Tom Edwards, and all the rest of the team here on Midori House, thanks for listening.